I want this morning to speak with you of the concept of truth. Our neighbors, many of them, are celebrating today an event which may never have been, and which many of them recognize may not have been. And on Wednesday night at our Seder, we celebrated the exodus from Egypt, the event which presumably saw the redeeming of the slaves, the passing through the sea dry shod, destruction of the pursuing hosts, the ultimate arrival of this generation of ex-slaves, and rather of their children, to the promised land. Now, the biblical chapter which describes the exodus from Egypt, the most complete, one might almost say the most inflated chapter, tells us that on the night of the 10th plague, that terrible plague which killed the firstborn in every Egyptian home, Pharaoh recognized that he could no longer delay granting the Hebrews permission to leave. And though it was near midnight, he summoned Aaron and Moses to the palace, and he tells them, "Kumu tzu mitochami, up and get out from the midst of my people." The Bible continues by telling us that the Egyptians, the common people, were even more insistent that the Jews leave. The Egyptians urged the Jews to rush out, to make haste. For they said, "Unless you leave, we will all die." And the Hebrews quickly assemble that same night. According to the text, 600,000 adults, not counting the children, or a group of people who are called the Erev Rav, a mixed multitude who accompany the slaves. And the slaves and their families and their herds and their cattle leave. And they travel from Pit'om, one of the store cities which they had been busy building as enforced labor, to a town somewhat to the south and east called Sukkot. And from there they move off into the wilderness. Now that's the story as the Bible tells it to us. And of course, if we seek the literal truth, we must ask who, how, when, how many were really involved, what's the kernel of truth which this legend encapsulates, or is in fact the statement true as it stands. Now, on the surface of things, the biblical description cannot be true as it reads. If 600,000 adult Jews and, let's say, half as many children left Egypt together with a mixed multitude, you'd have a population movement of about 1 million people. And in the New Kingdom, at the height of its glory, there were probably no more than 2.5 million Egyptians. No population movement in ancient times numbered anywhere as near that size. Indeed, if it had, it would have set political events in motion throughout the ancient Middle East. The numbers are simply implausible. And one answer, of course, is to retranslate the Hebrew, which says that 600 Eleph left Egypt, and say that Eleph means not thousands, but that it means companies, and to say that a company numbers 5 or 10 or 20, and therefore to reduce the numbers considerably. But that's, of course, not what the biblical text says. It says that 600,000 men left Egypt outside of the children and this mixed multitude. And so on the surface of things, the biblical story is unbelievable, not believable. And we must ask then and seek then, if we are interested in literal truth, historic truth, we must ask, what were the events, what actually happened? And when we try to parse down, to tie down the actual events, we find that we are facing a great deal of uncertainty. One of the problems is that the Torah never tells us exactly which pharaoh is involved. It says pharaoh simply means king, czar, emperor. And the regnal years of the pharaohs of the new kingdom are fairly well known. And if we could, if the Bible had named the pharaoh, we'd be enabled at least to tell us within a few years the date of the Exodus. But unfortunately, we know neither the name of the pharaoh under whom Joseph came down to Egypt, nor the name of the pharaoh who knew not Joseph, who enslaved the Hebrews, nor the name of the pharaoh who Moses dealt with and negotiated with when he sought to bring the Hebrews, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And all attempts to be able to date the Exodus with any kind of certainty have faltered on the uncertainty, the lack of precision in the biblical text, and on the fact that there are no external sources on which we can depend. We have no corroboration of the Exodus from sources outside of the Bible itself. And so almost all attempts to date, that is to place in time at least, the Exodus, require that we engage in a good bit of scholarly deduction. And here again we face a number of problems. The Hebrews, we are told in the Bible, were set to work when they were enslaved on two cities, Pithom and Ramses. Now Ramses is also the name of a series of great pharaohs. And Ramses II, who lived between, let's say, 1300 and 1250, was one of the great Napoleonic builders of ancient times. And so it is tempting to say that the Hebrews were placed to work around 1300 on these great building projects of this Egyptian Napoleon. And sometime later, say around 1260 or 1250, they left Egypt. But of course, that's pure deduction. There's another way of arguing, and that is to say that archaeology has found that in Israel, a number of the great ancient Canaanite cities were destroyed between around the year 1250 and around the year 1180. And that when they were subsequently rebuilt, they were rebuilt in much smaller size and with evidence of much less prosperity, rebuilt by seemingly by desert people rather than by people who had the rich civilization of Canaan. Which would suggest that the period of the conquest is to be dated around 1250, 1180, and that the enslavement must have taken place a generation or two or three before that. Others argue that there is a stele of a pharaoh by the name of Merneptah, who ruled in Egypt around the year 1220, which describes the fact that his armies had a number of victories against a people known as the Israelites. In fact, it says that Israel is no more. And if this be the case, there must have been established cities and settlements in Israel long before the year 1220. And one pushes back then the date of the conquest of the Exodus into the 13th or the 14th century. And so when we search for dates, when we search for corroborating events, we find ourselves uncertain, unclear as to exactly the series of events. And so it's a matter of some major interest when a well-known scholar announces, as if one did this year, that he can date the Exodus precisely to a given year and that he has found corroborating evidence of the Exodus having in fact taken place in a document which exists outside of the Bible. And that man is a man named Hans Godecky, who is an Egyptologist who teaches and is in fact chairman of the Department of Near Eastern Studies at the Johns Hopkins University. And Dr. Godecky has argued this during the course of this year that a retranslation by him of a rock inscription in a temple in Middle Egypt near a place called Beni Hassan, a temple which was built by a queen, a pharaoh, who ruled as pharaoh, Hatshepsut, around the year 1470 before the Common Era, refers directly to the Exodus and gives us a series of information which we didn't have before. According to Dr. Godecky, the Exodus is to be dated to the year 1477 before the Common Era, about 200 years before the consensus dating which has existed till now. And he dates it because in that year, a volcano on the island of Thera, which is an island about 30 miles to the southeast of the island of Crete, erupted. It's a famous eruption. It's the eruption which brought hail and brimstone upon the great Minoan civilization, which had its capital at Knossos in Crete, and brought about the end of that great civilization. And according to Dr. Godecky, the description in the Bible that when the Israelites went out to Egypt, they were led by a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night refers precisely to the kind of fire and brimstone which would be seen over the entire eastern Mediterranean if there was a volcanic eruption of this size and magnitude. Now, the basis of his dating is this rock inscription. It's a difficult inscription, which he claims to have been the first to fully decipher. And according to him, the inscription of Queen Hatshepsut says that during the years in which she was establishing her reign, it was unusual for a woman to rule as the pharaoh. And when she had tried to take over the throne after the death of her father, there were a number of challenges to her authority. And these were difficult years. And during these difficult years, according to the inscription, the Asiatics who were in Egypt rebelled. And after she has asserted her authority, she says her uraeus, which is that cobra-headed symbol on the crown of the Egyptian, breathed fire, and she was able to restrain, destroy the rebellion, put it down. And when she put it down, the footsteps of the Asiatics were blotted out from upon the face of the earth because the god Nun, who was the god of the primal water, suddenly one day asserted his power. And according to Dr. Godecki, this assertion of the Nun's power would speak of a great flood, a tidal wave consequent upon this eruption of Thera. The spitting fire by the uraeus symbol would be a reference to the volcanic eruption, the fire that accompanied it. And all of this ties together, and according to him, it just so happens that around the year 1477, the Hebrew slaves were fleeing from Egypt, and they had camped at night on some high ground in the Delta area, which is low ground, and they were being pursued by some military police. And when the tidal wave struck, the military police, who were encamped as armies do on the low ground, were submerged, and the Israelites in the high ground were saved. And that's the great Reed Sea or Red Sea story, which, as the Bible tells it. Now, I must tell you also that no one else besides Dr. Godecki believes this story. Not only is the burden of scholarly opinion against him, but most of those who have looked carefully at this text say, one, it does not say what Dr. Godecki would have it say, and two, even if it says what Dr. Godecki would have it say, it speaks of Asiatics and not necessarily of Hebrews. The use of language such as uraeus spits fire is simply an idiom, which means the queen was very angry, and there is no reason to build out the rest of the scenario as Dr. Godecki has done. But it's fascinating to see how again and again and again there have been attempts by otherwise rational people to prove out, to find the exact historic basis for such an event as the Exodus. I remember some 20 years ago, I was invited by a member of one of the so-called literary groups in Cleveland to attend a meeting which he thought I'd be interested in. A noted geologist was going to speak on the date of the Exodus. And he knew that I cared about the Bible, and he thought I'd be interested in going. And this geologist was a fascinating man. He was a professor at Case, who was otherwise rational, and who had done a lot of research into weather patterns and into geological formations. And he had read the story in the Bible that a great east wind had blown over the Reed Sea, and supposedly the waters had backed up, and the Israelites had crossed dry shod, and then the winds had receded, and the waters had swamped and drowned the Egyptians. And by charting various kinds of weather patterns and known earthquakes and some seismographic evidence, which I couldn't follow, he was able to place and to date exactly where the Israelites had crossed the Red Sea. They had begun at a point 20 miles below the tip of the Red Sea, and he had the exact name of the place. He visited the place, and they crossed. It was a matter, he said, only of a kilometer or so, and the waters are shallow, and there's good footing underneath. He'd investigated. He'd gone to scuba diving, and he investigated and made sure. And he had the whole thing charted and proven. And I listened, and there was a great deal of discussion about his charts, and I finally raised my hand, and I said, "Doctor, you know, it's all very interesting. There's only one problem, and that is that about 20 years ago, Egyptologists discovered that the word Red Sea, Yam Suf, does not mean Red Sea. That Suf is it turns out to be an Egyptian word, which means the Sea of Reeds, the Sea of Bulrushes, And it's much more likely that the Bible refers to one of the bayous in the Delta area, which in which the papyrus reed and other bulrushes grow, than it does to the Red Sea. The Red Sea translation goes back to a man named Jerome, who was a good Latin scholar and knew some Hebrew and knew no Egyptian, and ever since it's been repeated in all the translations. And he thanked me for my comment and went right back to his lecture. And about a year and a half or 2 years later, I noticed he was giving the same lecture elsewhere in town. And I'm sure with the same conclusions. What I'm saying is that there's no way of knowing exactly when the Exodus took place, or how many were involved in the exodus of the slaves, or in fact, whether such miracles as the Bible describes, such events did in fact accompany the Exodus. What we do know, is that beginning in the 13th century before the Common Era, a loose confederation of semi-Bedouin tribes began to come into the land of Canaan from various directions. There seems to have been a population explosion among these peoples for reasons which we do not quite understand. Many of these tribes began to move into the area before the Exodus could have taken place, which suggests clearly that not all of the tribes were involved in the Egyptian episode. And that as they drew together into a confederation, a league of some 12 tribes eventually, they brought together a series of records or remembrances of their past, which included a remembrance of having been enslaved in Egypt and having been delivered from Egypt by their God. Now, the movement of Asiatics into Egypt is not at all unusual. It was a constant, there was a constant flow of traffic in both directions in ancient times. The enslavement of Asiatics would come down as free men to pasture their flocks in the lands of the Nile Valley when there was a drought in their own lands in or near the Jordan Valley was again not unknown. Dynastic changes took place with some regularity for reasons of policy or otherwise. Those who had been welcomed by one generation were often enslaved by the next. We do know that to accomplish their great building projects, the emperors of the new kingdom required large numbers of workers, and where better to find them than among those who were not Egyptians whom they could easily enslave. Indeed, it's possible to suggest that the story of Joseph, of how the Jews came down to Egypt in the first place, is not at all implausible at least, because between the year 1850 and the year 1550 of before the Common Era, an alien dynasty ruled Egypt, known as the Hyksos. These were feudal people, hill people from the Anatolian mountains who came down to Egypt in the 19th century. They were militarily superior to the Egyptians. They had developed the war chariot. They were able, as a feudal group, to conquer Egypt. But lacking numbers, they needed others to help them to administer this conquered land. And so they encouraged those who could read and write among the West Asians and non-Egyptians to come down and join their administration. So the Joseph story is not implausible historically, followed by a period of enslavement, followed by the deliverance we know not how or when or why, a deliverance which forever made a great mark on the conscience of the Hebrew peoples. And that's all we know. We don't know if they were led out of Egypt by the man Moses, or if in fact Moses is the name of some great later leader whose career was somehow enlarged to include the Exodus. We don't know precisely which groups were involved in Egypt. All we know is that the people carried with them this historical memory. And the question I would ask you this morning is really the question, does it make any real difference what the events were? When they took place, under what Pharaoh, how many Hebrews were involved? And the answer I would suggest to you is it doesn't make very much difference. It'd be interesting to know, but if in fact we did know, we'd be no better or worse Jews for the knowledge. What is important is to recognize that the Bible does not set out to present to us historic truth. The Bible is not a history book. The Bible records the acts of God, not the acts of men. Rather, the Bible is a presentation by those who cared about God of their understanding of what God had done from creation through time. Their special history, their special relationship with God. God's relationship to mankind, God's relationship to Israel, God's will for mankind, the instructions he had given to Israel. And these events are expounded, explained in a way which presents a truth which is, in a sense, deeper than the truth which would exist if we were dealing with literal truth, surface truth. It deals with meaning rather than with historic fact. It suggests what? It suggests that God wills man to be free. That God created a universe in which there would be sufficient, a good earth, and he willed man to establish on earth a just society. And that God is unhappy with, angry with any society which oppresses people, which enslaves people, which denies to people their rights to their share of the earth's opportunity. Somehow, these ancient semi-Bedouins, the Israelites, were able to look at an event which might have been explained as a matter of luck or a matter of chance or the fact that in some interregnal period in Egypt, while before one pharaoh had been able to establish his authority over the land after the death of another pharaoh or during some dynastic squabble among pretenders to the throne, there had been a chance for a small group or a group of some size to escape from bondage. And that instead of looking upon this escape geopolitically, historically, practically, realistically, they looked upon it religiously, spiritually. They sought the meaning of the event. And they'd found the meaning of the event in the will of God. They'd located their history, the reason for all that happened to them in God's purposes, in God's wisdom. God meant them to be free as a symbol that all mankind was meant to be free. And they went further and they recognized that freedom is not only freedom from bondage, that is, freedom from the shackles of someone else's authority, but that it is freedom from one's own ignorance, freedom from one's own, from idolatry, freedom from bigotry, freedom from all those things which shackle the human spirit. Because as they told the biblical story, they saw that the wilderness trek, not simply as a passage from one oasis to another, much as we describe the trek of those who took the covered wagons west in the United States. Not simply how they went from one fort to another, from one place into another, and the series of events, the Indian attacks, the lack of water which happened to them along the way. They saw the wilderness trek as a symbolic moment in which a people was forged out of an agglomeration of individuals. When the slaves left Egypt, they began to rebel. They began to be cantankerous. They couldn't agree among themselves. They complained against Moses. Here they were free, but freedom wasn't enough. They weren't able to sustain freedom. They cried within a day or two, take us back to the flesh pots of Egypt. We can't make up our mind. We can't accept the hardships of the way. And so freedom is followed almost immediately, 3 months later, by Sinai, by a willing acceptance of a rule, which is God's rule, a good rule, a rule which gives the people coherence and direction and a sense of purpose. It's not only freedom from, but freedom for. And somehow, having created out of a set of events which others might have explained as simply happenstance, or others might be tempted to explain simply in terms of power and politics and opportunity, the Hebrews explained what had happened to them in terms of life itself, in terms of the universal human dimension. A dimension which is independent of time and place, because it applies to all peoples at all times and in all places. We are free, yet many of our community are not free. There are the prisoners of conscience to whom we owe a duty. We are free, but many in our world still labor under authoritarian regimes, and we must do what we can to encourage them to come into their own. We are free, but no one could say that our society uses its freedom intelligently and wisely. We are an indulgent society. We are an addicted society. We are a society which has often given over its opportunity because we are creatures of passion or pleasure or whatever. We too need our Sinai. We too need to say to a set of higher obligations, Naaseh v'nishma, we will do, then we will listen. We accept a sense of duty beyond the opportunity which freedom gives us. And so the truth of the Bible is not what lies on the surface of the text, it's what lies within it, what it represents, and what it suggests. The word paradise is a Persian word. It was transported into Hebrew as the word pardes. And the rabbis said that the word pardes, paradise, is an acronym for four kinds of interpretation to which Scripture ought to be subjected. The P, pardes, is the pshat, the simple literal meaning. That is what it seems to say on the surface. There probably was an event. This is not an imagined, something, this is not purely a work of fiction. The D, dagash, that which is what I've done today, to interpret, to universalize, to find the meaning within. And then two esoteric forms of translation, remez, which means the allegory, and sod, which means the secrets, the depths which one can hardly imagine, but which are there. The Bible remains central to our religious tradition, not because it describes events that were in the way that they took place, exactly as they took place, but because it describes events which our ancestors were able to drain of their meaning and expose that meaning for all in future generations who have eyes to see. And so during this Passover season, the issue is not, did the Exodus take place in 1477 before the Common Era or in 1250 before the Common Era? Were all 12 tribes involved, or two, or six, or none? The question is, what do we do with our own lives as we relate them to the meaning expressed in this ancient set of events? God wills man to be free. Have we made the best use of our freedom? Are we committed to those polities which will encourage freedom for the peoples of the world? And most of all, can any of us say that we have used the opportunity which is freedom for the greater good and for our own good only? Or have we been like the ancient liberated Israelites who complained and were stiff-necked and were cantankerous, who thought more of their bellies than of their opportunity, and who were so caught up in that which does not broaden the spirit, that which does not grace life, that God had to destroy that whole generation in the wilderness so that a generation born into freedom might begin the conquest of the land. The Bible is true, but in a way that far too few truly recognize.